Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Mario Ritter Jr. This program is designed for English learners. So we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Coming up on the show, Andrew Smith presents Ask a Teacher. Pete Musto and John Russell have the Everyday Grammar Report. And we close with an American story. Today we hear The Last Part of the Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. But now, archaeological research has uncovered another treasure of the ancient Roman city of Pompeii, a large private bathhouse. The explosion of Mount Vesuvius in 70 AD buried Pompeii in thick ash, wreckage, and lava, or hot liquid rock. Archaeologists are continuing to find remains of the city under the ground. The bathhouse was part of a large private house, the scientists said. The bathhouse holds a series of rooms that would have provided hot, warm, or cold conditions. The art and design of the complex, including mosaic works, also suggest the owner was wealthy. We have here perhaps the largest thermal complex in a private house in Pompeii, said Gabriel Zuchtriegel, director of the Pompeii Archaeological Park. He explained that Pompeii's powerful and wealthy set up large spaces at their homes to hold major gatherings for ceremonies and other purposes. It was an opportunity to show the wealth in which they lived and also to have a nice thermal treatment, he said. The baths were unearthed in the so-called Regio Nine, a large central area of Pompeii Park that is still unexplored. Recently, archaeologists working in the same area found a bakery, a laundry, and two homes. They also found the bones of three people who died in the volcanic burst. Pompeii was not the only city destroyed in the explosion. It also buried the city of Herculaneum. Zuchtriegel said wealthy citizens of Pompeii often would first take a bath and then attend a banquet or a big meal. The private thermal complex permitted them to do so together at the home where the banquet was held. There is room for about 30 people who could do the whole routine, and that could also be done in public baths. So there is the caldarium, a very warm environment, and also a large tub with cold water, he said. I'm Katie Weaver.
The new school year is beginning in communities across the United States. Many students are busy at work in their new classes. Some are already thinking about all the homework they will face in the weeks to come. Schools often require students to read academic articles, short or long reports about a class-related subject. teachers also ask students to write book reports and research papers. Today on Everyday Grammar, we will explore two grammatical structures that you will see often in academic writing. We will show you how to use those structures. We also will show you when not to use them.
If you are writing or reading for academic purposes, you will likely see the following structure: it plus is plus an adjective plus a that clause. This is a common way to express an attitude, opinion, or position. It is often used when considering an idea, note grammar experts Susan Conrad and Douglas Biber. Here is an example.
It is clear that the evidence is inconsistent.
Here is how you can understand the sentence. The subject in our example is the word it. Then comes the verb is. After is, there is an adjective, the word clear. After clear, there is a that clause. A that clause is a group of words beginning with the word that. It has a subject and a predicate. A predicate is the part of a sentence that expresses what is said about the subject. The that clause has the idea that the writer is considering. In the example we gave you, the idea under consideration is the following statement: the evidence is inconsistent. The adjective clear suggests the writer's judgment. By saying it is clear, the writer is saying that he or she agrees the evidence appears to be conflicting with other information. Note that the writer did not write, "I think that the evidence is inconsistent," even if it has the same meaning as the example sentence. Why? We will explore that issue later in the report. Academic writers often use it plus is plus an adjective plus a that clause to raise questions, note possibility, and express importance. For example, you might read the following sentence.
It is unlikely that the results will be conclusive.
Or,
it is likely that the information was incomplete.
In the former case, the writer is using the adjective unlikely to raise questions. In the latter one, the writer is using the adjective likely to express possibility.
A second common structure, it plus is plus an adjective plus an infinitive phrase, is often used to judge an action. The infinitive phrase describes the action. The adjective shows the writer's evaluation. Consider this example.
It is difficult to define these ideas.
In this example, the infinitive to define relates to an action, while the adjective difficult shows the writer's evaluation. Writers often use it plus is plus an adjective plus an infinitive phrase to show possibility, difficulty, importance, and so on. So, for example, you might read the following sentences.
It is hard to understand these effects.
Or,
it is necessary to carry out further research.
In the former example, the writer is expressing difficulty, while in the latter, the writer is expressing necessity.
The two structures we have discussed are common in academic writing. You should try using them with your own adjectives, that clauses, infinitive phrases, and so on. There is one point to keep in mind, however. you should know that sometimes you might not want to use these structures, especially if you are writing for business or even artistic reasons. In those situations, it might be better to use more direct language. Consider the first example we gave you.
It is clear that the evidence is inconsistent.
This is a common, acceptable way to write a sentence for academic purposes. It is grammatically correct. However, the statement uses indirect language to express an evaluation. The writer is expressing an opinion without specifically writing, "I think," for example. However, if you are writing for purposes other than college professors, you could simplify your language. You could give a very direct evaluation by writing, "I think the evidence is inconsistent," or simply, "The evidence is inconsistent." The structure that you choose to use depends on what kind of writing you are doing. It is difficult to improve your writing, but with practice, you can do it. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Pete Musto.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Doraemon in Japan. Here is Doraemon's question.
Hi, VOA. For me, as an English learner, words like clash, crash, and crush sound like the same word. Can you help me to tell one word from others? Thank you.
I'm happy to answer this question, Doraemon. When a foreign language contains sounds that do not exist in a person's native language, it can be difficult for learners to hear those sounds. The reason you have difficulty hearing the difference between crash and clash is because the Japanese language does not have the consonant sounds R or L. And when English speakers are talking quickly, the difference between the sounds of R and L becomes very small. As a result, those two consonants can sound the same to a native Japanese speaker. Some vowel sounds can also be difficult to hear or pronounce, depending on the vowels a person's native language has. For example, consider the difference between the following two words.
Hit, heat.
The Spanish language has the vowel sound in the word heat, but it does not have the vowel sound in the word hit. As a result, Spanish speakers will sometimes pronounce words like hit, bit, and little with an E sound. For example, the two words hit and heat will both sound like heat when spoken with a Spanish accent. You can learn to hear the difference between sounds in a foreign language by careful practice using minimal pairs. Minimal pairs are two words that differ from each other by only one sound. For example, the two words hit and heat differ from each other by only one sound. Here are some tips for using minimal pairs. Find lists and recordings of minimal pairs through a Google search or on YouTube. For Japanese speakers, find minimal pairs that differ between the sounds of R and L. B
Be sure to include minimal pairs that place the two sounds at the beginning, middle, and end of words. Here are examples.
Rake, lake. Correct, collect. Hair, hail.
Carefully listen to the pronunciation of the minimal pairs. At first, it might be difficult for you to hear the difference between them. But over time, you will start hearing the difference. Also, practice pronouncing these sounds. Learning to pronounce them can help you hear them. To pronounce them, you need to practice putting your tongue in the correct position. The tongue is a muscle. Just as we can train our muscles to play a sport, we can train our tongue to move to the correct positions for pronouncing a foreign language. This How to Pronounce video from VOA Learning English shows the tongue positions you need to pronounce the letters R and L correctly. For our readers and listeners, what are your questions about American English? We want to hear from you. Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And please let us know where you are from, too. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Andrew Smith.
The Blue Hotel, Part 4.
The Swede's face, fresh from Johnny's blows, felt more pleasure than pain in the wind and the whipping snow. A number of square shapes appeared before him, and he recognized them as the houses of the town. He traveled along a street until he found a saloon. He pushed open the door and entered. At the end of the room, four men sat drinking at a table. The Swede dropped his bag upon the floor and, smiling at the saloon keeper, said,
"Give me some whiskey, will you?"
The man placed a bottle, a whiskey glass, and a glass of ice-filled water upon a table. The Swede poured himself an extra large amount of whiskey and drank it down.
"Bad night,"
remarked the saloon keeper, without interest. He was acting as though he were not noticing the man, but it could have been seen that he was secretly studying the remains of blood on the Swede's face.
"Bad night,"
he said again.
"Oh, it's good enough for me,"
replied the Swede as he poured himself some more whiskey.
"No,"
continued the Swede,
"this isn't too bad weather. It's good enough for me."
The large drinks of whiskey made the Swede's eyes watery, and he breathed a little heavier.
"Well, I guess I'll take another drink,"
said the Swede after a while.
"Would you like something?"
"No, thanks. I'm not drinking. How did you hurt your face?"
The Swede immediately began to talk loudly.
"Oh, in a fight. I beat the soul out of a man at Scully's Hotel."
This caught the interest of the four men at the table.
"Who was it?"
asked one.
"Johnny Scully, son of the man who owns the hotel. He will be nearly dead for some weeks, I can tell you. I beat him well, I did. He couldn't get up. They had to carry him into the house. Have a drink."
Instantly, the men, in a quiet way, surrounded themselves in privacy.
"No, thanks,"
said one. It was a strange group. two were well-known local businessmen. One was a lawyer, and one was a gambler. But a close look at the group would not have enabled an observer to pick the gambler from the other men. He was, in fact, so delicate in manner and so careful with whom he gambled that the men of the town completely trusted and admired him. His business was regarded with fear and lack of respect. That is why, without doubt, his quiet dignity shone brightly above the quiet dignity of men who might be merely hat makers or builders or salesmen. Beyond an occasional unwise traveler who came by rail, this gambler supposedly cheated only careless farmers who, when rich with good crops, drove into town full of foolish pride. Hearing at times of such a farmer, the important men of Romper usually laughed at his losses. And if they thought of the gambler at all, it was with a kind of pride of knowing he would never dare to attack their wisdom and courage. Besides, it was known that this gambler had a wife and two children in a nice little house, where he led a perfect home life. And when anyone even suggested that there was a fault in his character, the men immediately described the virtues of his family life. And one must not forget to declare the bare fact of his entire position in Romper. It is true that in all affairs other than his business, this card player was so generous, so fair, so good, that he could be considered to have a higher moral sense than 9/10 of the citizens of Romper. And so it happened that he was seated in this saloon with two local businessmen and the lawyer. The Swede continued to drink whiskey and to try to make the saloon keeper drink with him.
Come on. Have a drink. Come on. No? Well, have a little one then. By God, I've beaten a man tonight. And I beat him good, too. Gentlemen,
the Swede cried to the men at the table.
Have a drink?
Shh, quiet,
said the saloon keeper. The group at the table, although really interested, had been trying to appear busy and talk. But now a man lifted his eyes towards the Swede and said shortly,
Thanks. We don't want any more.
At this reply, the Swede straightened.
Well,
he shouted,
it seems I can't get anybody to drink with me. I want someone to drink with me now. Now! Do you understand?
He struck the table with his hand. Years of experience had hardened the saloon keeper. He merely answered,
I hear you.
Well,
cried the Swede,
listen then. See those men over there? Well, they're going to drink with me, and don't you forget it. Now you watch.
Stop that,
shouted the saloon keeper.
Why should I?
Demanded the Swede. He walked to the men's table and by chance laid his hand on the shoulder of the gambler.
What about it?
He asked angrily.
I asked you to drink with me.
The gambler simply turned his head and spoke over his shoulder.
My friend, I don't know you.
Never mind,
answered the Swede.
Come and have a drink.
Now, my boy,
advised the gambler kindly,
take your hand off my shoulder and go away.
He was a little, thin man, and it seemed strange to hear him use this tone to the big Swede. The other men at the table said nothing.
What? You won't drink with me, you little fool? I'll make you, then. I'll make you.
The Swede had grasped the gambler fiercely at the throat and was dragging him from his chair. The other men jumped up. The saloon keeper ran toward the table. There was a great scene of shouts and movements, and then a long knife appeared in the hand of the gambler. It shot forward, and a human body was cut as easily as if it had been a piece of fruit. The Swede fell with a cry of greatest surprise. The businessman and the lawyer must have rushed out of the place backward. The saloon keeper found himself hanging weakly to the arm of a chair and gazing into the eyes of a murderer.
Henry,
said the latter,
you tell them where to find me. I'll be home waiting.
Then he left. A moment afterward, the saloon keeper was in the street, racing through the storm for help and, more important, companionship. Months later, the cowboy was cooking meat on the stove of a small cattle farm near the Dakota border when there was the sound of a horse stopping outside. The Easterner entered with mail and newspapers.
Well,
said the Easterner at once,
the fellow who killed the Swede will spend 3 years in prison. That's not much, is it?
He will? 3 years?
The cowboy turned the meat in the pan.
3 years? That isn't much.
No,
replied the Easterner.
There was a lot of sympathy for him in Romper.
If the saloon keeper had been any good,
said the cowboy thoughtfully,
he would have gone in and hit that Swede on the head with a bottle in the beginning of it. That would have stopped all this murdering.
Yes, 1,000 things might have happened,
said the Easterner sharply. The cowboy moved his pan of meat on the fire, continued with his philosophy.
It's strange, isn't it? If he hadn't said Johnny was cheating, he'd be alive this minute. He was an awful fool. I believe he was crazy.
I feel sorry for that gambler,
said the Easterner.
So do I,
said the cowboy.
He doesn't deserve 3 years in prison for killing that fellow.
The Swede might not have been killed if everything had been honest.
Might not have been killed,
exclaimed the cowboy.
Everything honest? When he said that Johnny was cheating and acted so crazy, and then in the saloon he practically asked to get hurt?
With these arguments, the cowboy made the Easterner angry.
You're a fool,
cried the Easterner fiercely.
You're a bigger fool than that Swede. Now let me tell you one thing. Let me tell you one thing. Listen. Johnny was cheating. Johnny,
said the cowboy blankly. There was a minute of silence, and then he said strongly,
oh, no. The game was only for fun.
Fun or not,
said the Easterner.
Johnny was cheating. I saw him. I know it. I saw him. And I refused to stand up and be a man. I let the Swede fight alone, and you were simply jumping around the place and wanting to fight. And old Scully, too. We are all in it. This poor gambler just got pulled into it. Every sin is the result of shared effort. We, 5 of us, have shared in the murder of this Swede. You, I, Johnny, old Scully, and that fool of an unfortunate gambler came merely at the end of a human movement and gets all the punishment.
The cowboy, hurt and angry, cried out blindly into this mystery of thought.
Well, I didn't do anything, did I?
Show for today, but join us again tomorrow to keep learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm...